Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, our engineer, Patricia Kohlberg. Where were you on this day, November 29th, 22 years ago? How about 5 years ago? For some of our listeners, for some of the old moles, at this hour, on this day, in 1999, we were gathering by buses on the way to Seattle to shut down the World Trade Organization. That effort to impose a corporation-dominated board over and beyond any national governmental institutions. That action, it's important to remember, was part of a democratic movement building worldwide, unfortunately derailed by the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and their aftermath. And 5 years ago, in 2016, this was a day of strikes across the country to raise the minimum wage, a day and a struggle organizers called Fight for 15. On today's Old Mole, we look at different strands of our interrelated struggles, from global to local: climate change, reproductive rights, community history. Into that rich mix will include some powerfully related poetry. I want to remind you also that tomorrow begins KBOO's end of the year drive. KBOO is on the air because of its listeners' support. The fall drive fell short. If you're able, please stay alert to the station's needs and contribute. And now for our radio conversations. Last week on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviewed Tina Gerhardt, a researcher and environmental journalist who observed this month's disappointing United Nations conference on reducing climate change. Today, they move from critique to what actually might work. Bill?
Hi, folks. Last week on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick, that's me, interviewed Tina Gerhardt, a researcher and environmental journalist who observed this month's International United Nations Conference on Reducing Climate Change to Manageable Levels. The conference was captured by corporate interests, and they developed plans that Gerhardt described as kicking the can down the road. Just a lot of talk and empty promises. These promises made to avoid the action that most people on Earth strongly support, and for very good reason. Today, Tina is on the line. We'll be discussing what now must be done to maintain a habitable planet, what might succeed. Over 100 cities around the world have achieved 100% renewable energy. Tina Gerhardt, did anybody at the International United Nations Conference, including the thousands of protesters, did anybody discuss how it was done?
Yeah, the activists, there were two enormous protests on Friday and on Saturday. I guess it's 10 days ago now. On Fridays, the huge demonstration was led by Fridays for Future, which is a weekly youth protest movement that was initiated by Greta Thunberg, the young climate activist in Sweden who did not go to school on Fridays, but instead was going to use that day to protest or otherwise take action to address the climate crisis. And it led to this global movement. I mean, there's people who participate in this in sub-Saharan Africa. Africa, in the Pacific, all over the U.S. And the youth movement in terms of climate activism has been a real beacon of hope, I guess one could say, or just a real highlight of the protests. And then there's such solidarity among different constituencies that one saw. Saturday was a global day of action that was convened, and there were solidarity protests around the world. And at the head of that protest movement were indigenous youth leaders, and they led the entire march and then were on the main stage. And both of them had many more participants in terms of the numbers of people that were expected. They had many more participants. It's the, like I said, the solidarity among these different constituent groups that are also really important to note. So young, there's also old, the above 60, through Bill McKibben just founded this organization called the Third Act, which is for people who want to work on the climate crisis who are older than 60. And I, you know, would encourage your listeners to check that new effort out. The indigenous peoples I mentioned, a lot of young people, people from different parts of the globe, people representing, you know, trade unions, farmers. I mean, it's just, it's incredible to see that kind of activism on the ground. One of the things I love about covering the COPs is really seeing those groups. Or people I talk to when they ask questions about COPs, they have a sense that there's the inside and the outside. And that's true. The negotiating halls looks and feels very different than the street activism does, not surprisingly. But in terms of the politics, I think it's important to remember that many nations from the global south, you know, Pacific Islanders, a lot of the G77 member nations are, you know, I'm using UN language here, the least developed countries, a lot of what they're lobbying and agitating for is very closely aligned with what the activists on the outside are also pushing for. So, you know, the inside-outside divide, that doesn't really work entirely because there are synergies between the two. In terms of retooling, the question that you asked, also opening up for discussion a bit, you know, the sideshows to the COP26. So all of the events that involve different industries, and this was pointed out by Global Witness, there were over 500 fossil fuel lobbyists there. That was more than any single country had in delegates. So that force of the industry, just by dint of those numbers alone, is incredible.
500?
Yes, 500. Which
five
is just,
zero zero.
Indeed, yeah. Fossil fuel lobbyists. And, you know, there are people who were calling for them to be banned. I mean, why are they attending? Nima Bassi, who used to be the executive director of Friends of the Earth International, he's an environmental activist from Nigeria. He said, you know, having them at this conference is kind of like inviting the alcohol industry to an Alcoholics Anonymous convention. It doesn't make any sense. I was at a press briefing where one of the journalists asked some members of different delegates, I think they were asking the COP president, Alok Sharma, actually. They said, you know, members of the lobby and oil lobby industry don't quite feel comfortable here. Do you have any comment on that? Oh, shucks, they feel uncomfortable. Okay. So that's a really big problem. And I think the other thing in terms of while we're talking about fossil fuels, if I didn't mention this in the opening, I think it's really important for your listeners to know that the U.S. does not have to include the emissions of its military in its annual emissions budget. Now, that is a huge problem because the military is among the largest, if not the largest emitter of anything in the U.S. I still have to parse those numbers, but, you know, I look for the points of action, right? Like, what action can we take, whether we're journalists or whether, you know, your listeners are activists or whether they're involved with policy reform or what have you? And that, I think, really needs to change. But to come back to your question about different industries that were there, such as solar panels, wind turbines, I unfortunately, in covering the events that were going on with the negotiations themselves, did not also have time to visit or track the sideshows that were going on in terms of the different industries that were there with the representatives. I think solar and wind are hugely important. Bill McKibben, in his article last week, said that the push to phase out fossil fuel subsidies certainly won't stop, and he said it's already having an effect, and he cited this article that was published by Bloomberg last week that said that the cost for the fossil fuel industry now is 4 to 6 times what it was a decade ago, 4 to 6 times more expensive to develop, to extract. And it used to be on par with renewables. Renewables have gotten much cheaper. Fossil fuels have gotten much more expensive. And I think this movement that's afoot to really encourage retirement pensions, universities, you know, go on down a list, really push entities to make sure that their investments are, they are out of fossil fuels. And then this increasing expense of the fossil fuel industry, I think that's really had an impact on their bottom line. And I think that's going to keep going. My interests are really, and I sense yours are too, are really about how do we retool the grid if renewables have become much more affordable, and if we have these plans going through in the U.S., I'm really curious what that could look like and what kinds of opportunities that could open up. The energy efficiency, which I think for people in the West is a really interesting one, all in the up and down the West Coast, just making your homes more energy efficient. But that's, I don't want to individualize the problem. I think it needs a systemic solution too.
This is Bill Resnick of the Old Mole on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, talking to Tina Gerhardt, an environmental journalist, discussing what must be done to reduce climate change to manageable levels. Tina just pointed out we need a systemic solution. I wholeheartedly agree. You know, we have to change our energy system very radically and quickly build out a renewable clean energy network, replace all fossil fuel burning, and do it real quickly. You know, my sense of it is that we have to change our energy system very radically. We cannot rely on the investor-owned utilities to do that. Their program would be vastly expensive, require a huge national grid cutting through the countryside. Furthermore, they're committed to producing as much energy as the economy needs. And they have no idea of what it would mean to actually have energy conservation and use reduction, which it seems to me if we only have 8 years or even 18, the only way we could possibly succeed is if we've, at least the United States, reached levels of energy use that the Europeans, that the average European has. We use twice as much energy, and it's not just because we have to travel in cars further. Although that's one of the factors, we have to begin thinking about what so many people are talking about, the energy democracy movement is moving towards local generation by local utilities, and local means cities, sometimes counties, sometimes in not densely populated areas, maybe whole very large regions, developing their own energy supplies. The sun and the wind are everywhere and can be efficiently used even in cold climates, even in places like Germany, which has gone a long way, or Oregon, that has a lot of cloud cover. Local energy can be built out quickly. You can get the materials right off the shelf. It can be done by local labor. It's not really require vast skills or highly professional engineering as the continent-spanning grid would and the investor-owned utilities depend on. If we really are serious about doing anything, we have to begin with the energy economy. The companies have no interest in reducing use. They want to increase use. They want to increase consumption. Unfortunately, the Chinese, they have adopted the American dream. And if we allow the corporate sector, even the ones who are ready to use sun and wind energy, but slowly they don't want to strand their assets. And that's why the phase out of fossil fuels is so attractive to them. Yes, let's phase them out. 40 years, 60 years, we'll phase them out. And they're perfectly happy with that, with the phase out. In fact, that's part of their strategy, is to phase out while building up slowly so that they can just maintain their system of they make great profits and live lavishly. And the people, you know, get to live in bigger homes and cars, except for the bottom 50% who suffer a lot, but we don't worry about them. It seems to me that capitalism has birthed these industries who are now dominant in politics and that are actively trying to sabotage what should be going on, which is this new energy system and really different ways of life that don't require that much energy. A way of life, though, that gives you a lot more time for creative work and dancing, if you like it. And, you know, there's a lot of, at least used to be a lot of work on Well, what would alternative culture look like? Barbara Ehrenreich's book, what was it called?
When you mentioned dancing, of course, If I Can't Dance, I Don't Want to Be in Your Revolution by Emma Goldman, that came to mind. But you're thinking of Barbara Ehrenreich dancing in the streets, maybe? Dancing in the streets?
Oh, yes, dancing in the streets, yeah.
Picking up on your points, I mean, I think what you mentioned at the very outset, the profit motive of the energy industry, well, you started even before that, and I should start one step back. You mentioned the discrepancies in energy consumption between, for example, the EU and the U.S., and I've spent some time reading up on this. So I actually came to working on the environment, not through the climate crisis. My aunt was one of the co-founders of the Green Party in the 80s, and I grew up seeing that in Germany and then started working to decommission military bases in the Bay Area, and also worked on the Nevada test site a bit, which was really, you know, the underground detonations there. Nuclear tests were really impacting the indigenous communities in the area, as well as other residents. So those are the kinds of things I was doing in the late 80s, early 90s, and I'm dating myself there, that predate this climate coverage. But to come back to those discrepancies in energy emissions, I read up on them a bit, and a lot of them have to do with the energy efficiency of buildings. So we're talking really humble, modest things like insulation from the roof down, because the roof is the most important place to do it. We're talking about the way that energy systems work within buildings. So I'm talking there instead of, you know, leaky gas, which is also a health risk inside buildings, using electricity. I'm thinking of caulking. You know, all of these things are really very mundane and very humble and modest, but they're very important. And then there's, you know, the amount of energy that, say, stoves use, the amount of energy that fridges use, any of these large appliances, washing machines, energy standards on a national level there, which could be regulated by policy, would go a long way to reducing the amount of energy that we use in our homes. But I think what you said after that is something that I'm also keenly interested in, which is how are we going to retool the grid, and how does that mesh with a profit motivated industry? And, you know, in California, where, you know, San Francisco for me is home, the Pacific gas and electric industry is just, PG&E is just, I mean, I can't even start talking about it because then I wouldn't be able to stop. I mean, the profit motive there is just writ large. The amount of lawsuits against PG&E for being responsible for starting some of the fires that happened in years past, and the amount that they had to pay with charges of manslaughter, I think they just take that into account in terms of their balancing the ledgers, and they're like, well, we had to pay that much out, but here's how much we made in profits. It's appalling to me. And retooling the energy grid is, I think, really important. There's two books I would really recommend to your readers. One is by Shalonda Baker, and it's published by Island Press, and the title of it is Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to Energy. And what she did is to the energy transition, she spent time in different communities. She grew up in Port Arthur, Texas, which is one of the three areas that has worst air qualities because of the oil industry, aside from New Orleans and Houston. She really spent a lot of time thinking about both her family history. Her father worked in this industry and passed young due to cancer, and then other family members also had health effects. She was thinking about her family history together with her work. She's an environmental lawyer, working with different communities in Hawaii and also in Oaxaca, and thinking about how renewable energy is implemented and who has access and control. And, you know, a lot of these energy grids do have seats where people can run for office. So if people know a lot, or people are retired and they want to learn a lot, they have the time, they want to, you know, really get involved with this and become informed and then run for one of these public office seats, there's nothing that prevents people from doing that. If people don't want to go to that level, they have public meetings. There's nothing that prevents people from going to these meetings and making their voices and opinions heard. I know here in New York, they just decided to not build two power plants in the New York City area because of the position of Princeton. They shut down two power plants. It prevented them from being built because New York, the state, said if we build them, they will not hold us to our state-level greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets. And I forget off the top of my head right now what they are. But, you know, your listeners could look up, like, does your state have those kinds of targets? And then if there are plans to build a new power plant or to keep one open, those are arguments that could be used. People should also look at what, if they're planned, what communities they would be located in, if they're open, what communities they're in. because there are often environmental justice issues in terms of where those power plants are located. They're very often located near poor black and brown communities, so that would be a reason, too, to shut them down. And then the other book I would recommend is a book by Leah Stokes. She is a professor of energy policy at University of California at Santa Barbara, also very, very knowledgeable on the issue of energy policy. And her book is Short-Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the U.S. Again, that's Short-Circuiting Policy. And she's just terrific. Both of these are just terrific speakers, and the kinds of things that they advocate in their writing are just really great food for thought. I think in terms of directions to take things coming out of COP26, these kinds of local efforts that we were just getting involved with your local community and energy policy in particular, I think that's a really good place to look. I do think that the activism is going to shift back to people's countries and local communities. But one thing I think is really important to know, if your listeners are, you know, listening to this show from somewhere in the global north, the actions that we take in the global north have an impact in the global south. So when we hear about the situations of frontline communities on a global level, be they, you know, low-lying Pacific Island atolls, or be they people who are suffering drought in Kenya or other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, I think it's really important to keep in mind that we're all connected. The actions that we take here not only help us in our communities, they also have an effect elsewhere.
Tina Gearhart, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Yes, you too.
Thanks, Bill and Tina. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. To introduce our next segment, here is Judith Arcana reading her poem, What If Your Mother? A poem about trying to talk with those who would suppress women's right to abortion.
Sometimes, when you talk to them, in argument, they say, what if your mother had an abortion? And then I say, she did, because it's true. Only that one wasn't me. It was somebody else. Nobody but my mother ever knew that baby. But they mean me, the people who say it. Mean, what if she aborted me? Like, that's hard to answer. They're so stupid, because what if she miscarried or gave me away? What if I drowned at the beach when I was 3? What if she loved someone else, not my dad? Then I wouldn't be here either. What if? What if? What's the point of asking this phony question? All you could ever answer is, then everything would be different, wouldn't it? One thing's sure, I wouldn't be standing here talking to some jerk who asked me that dumb question. I wouldn't be mad at my mother for doing it, would I? I think you just have to tell these people, get real. That's not what it's all about.
What interests are served by repressing abortion rights? And what actually is the effect of that repression? It's been suggested that the effect, if not the intent, is not so much to deter women from seeking abortions as it is to make abortion unsafe. This morning, Old Mole Patricia Kohlberg speaks with Judith Arcana, one of whose poems you just heard.
Good morning. I have with me today on the Old Mole, Judith Arcana, who is a poet, writer, reproductive rights activist, and a Jane, a member of Chicago's pre-Roe Underground Abortion Service. Judith is the author of many books, including Hello, This is Jane, a fiction collection that includes stories based on the Chicago Underground. So Judith, welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks. It's a treat, of course, always to be with the moles.
So I wanted to start our conversation this morning to talk a little bit about what we already know about abortion. And the first is that throughout history in all societies, among all classes, races, and religions, in sanctioned ways or in violation of prohibitions, women have always sought to control their own reproduction by terminating those unwanted pregnancies. We also know that abortion laws have much less effect on rates of abortion than you might think. Rates of abortion in the global South for example, where it is largely illegal, are comparable, in fact, even a little bit higher than as compared to rates of abortion in the global north, where abortion is largely legal. The main effect of making abortion illegal is to make it unsafe. Another thing we know is that abortion is either prosecuted or tolerated, not because of what laws are on the books, but depends much more on the prevailing social and political context. And the most striking example, I know you're aware of, Judith, of this disconnect between the laws and abortion access is during World War II, when women were desperately needed as workers in the war economy. Abortion during that time was illegal across the United States, but in many, if not most, locales, authorities chose to look the other way. And in those places, abortion was not only easily accessed, it was safe. So the question that I want to ask you first is, under what kinds of social and political conditions do reproductive rights come under attack? Or in other words, what interests are served by repressing abortion rights?
Yeah, that's one of the crucial questions, all right. And I've been thinking a lot about those social and political conditions. I'm thinking particularly about in the moment in which we are talking, in this year, in this month, in the United States, the enormous, or I consider it enormous, upsurge of antisocial behavior, of rancor, both personally, privately, and literally in the streets, between and among groups of people. Lots and lots of people are very unhappy, very angry, very motivated to take out that anger in a variety of ways. Now, it has, of course, been building for quite some time, years, in fact. And I think that the buildup is congruent with the anti-abortion movement's actions and the fervor that they have sparked and fostered in their adherents, and also in people who aren't necessarily adherents, but who are easily struck by, yes. And of course, one of the central thoughts, one of the central concerns there is about the lives of women. I mean, this is, after all, a misogynist / sexist, et cetera, anti-woman society in many, many ways. That's not news. And the anti-abortion movement uses that fact. They're not stupid. They're clever and effective. And one of the things that they play on is the idea that women should be, it's so old-fashioned, it's almost hard to say these words, in the home, raising children, in the kitchen, not necessarily the old saw, barefoot and pregnant, but pretty close. And that is still part of the vision, which may seem bizarre, but I think that it's reality and that it's fostering this at the same time that it's a result of this movement.
Well, it's part of the cultural wars, for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
And can be thought of, I think, as a strategy by elites to pump up their base, get them riled up, and to support them, but as kind of a screen for what they are doing in terms of serving their own economic interests. So it's a way to, to rile up the base. But it's also, as you mentioned, very misogynist. And I think that's been true throughout history, that what we see is a pattern of repression of reproductive rights coming up as a kind of anti-feminist backlash.
Not just about feminists, it's about the fact of the existence of female humans. rights. And I agree with you completely about this business of using it, you know, as a political tool, so that people, for instance, vote, people of various genders, vote against their own interests time after time, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, most notably, I should say, about salaries, about jobs, about all the health of the environment, whatever is good for people can take second place or last place compared to attacks on women that are sort of like, those are technicolor. And the other issues are in black and white. So yeah, definitely a very clever and apparently effective method.
The repression of abortion rights was really in the 20th century was most severe following World War II, which was a period during which women were in the workplace to a very large degree. But the other thing that was going on during World War II, and I think is part of the dynamic of the repression of reproductive rights, is the desire to control what is considered as the destabilizing effect of rampant female sexuality, if you want to put it that way.
Well, you could. Yeah. The idea of women and even adolescent girls, or maybe especially, but certainly adolescent girls as well, high school students, let's say, the idea of those people being not only overtly sexual, but not simply as targets of interest from male people, but of their own selves. And so the conversations that began in the 50s and moved very, very richly, may I say, into the 60s and 70s about how women could pleasure themselves and how even if they were having sex with male people, the pleasure had to take them into consideration. That was definitely not appreciated in many quarters and considered unnatural in many quarters.
Another issue that I think looms very large is eugenics / white supremacy. There's been a long historical trend of wanting to, among anti-abortionists or right-wing circles, of wanting to preserve the right kinds of births to make sure that the people who are being born are primarily white. You know, it's a kind of the nativist panic. Talk a little bit more about that, and particularly as it relates to what we see today going on.
Well, I think that, I mean, I agree with you. The eugenics movement, strikingly, in many, certainly here and in Britain, was, if not led by, sparked by, and worked by women. Women who were white and upper middle class or outright wealthy elites, who wanted exactly what you just articulated, Patsy, only the right people to be born. And so the wrong people had to be, or the people who might make the wrong people had to be sterilized, if not outright murdered, both methods used. And that, again, I mean, so often when we look at kinds of questions you're asking, we think, well, what do they not see contradictions here? Do they not see that killing people, you know, they're so worried about killing fetuses, they're so worried about killing little, you know, in the very earliest day, little packs of cells, and yet they're perfectly willing to suit their own purposes, which is to create the white race and people who, in their opinions, not only had whiteness going for them, but were somehow believed to be intellectually and socially superior, et cetera, et cetera. And that in the interest of fostering more of those births, the very antithesis of their supposed arguments against abortion or even contraception was their method.
There is this contradiction that I thought about, well, if they ban abortion, of course, that means more births of black and brown babies. But it's conceived of, I think, within those circles as being primarily a problem that plays out in the white population. And actually, I even encountered folks writing from that nativist, white supremacist position that they would happily support abortion for Black and brown people, just not for white people. One other argument that is made about abortion is that abortion or the repression of it can serve to control labor supply. I think that's slightly problematic. I think the argument is that if you permit abortion and you permit women to have their own work lives and limit their families and not just stay at home, then you may not have the big supply of cheap labor that you need. That it's, in other words, it's in the interests of the elites, the people who control the economy, who profit from a capitalist economy, want a big, cheap labor supply. The problem, of course, is that if you have very high unemployment, then you have lots and lots of impoverished people who then call on the assets of the states because, you know, the welfare state. And so it becomes a problem that way.
Right. Yeah. Also, another effect of having all those, quote, sort of extra people is that those people can get angry. Those people, dare I say it, rise up. And indeed, those people have on more than one or two or three or four occasions.
So what are the ways in which repression of abortion rights or more broadly reproductive rights gets visited more specifically on communities of color?
In an overtly racist society like this one, everything that is damaging to children or to women or to men who are unemployed, or, you know, pick a group that is a likely victim slash target, is visited more hideously on people of color because the fundament is racist. And so when you're doing things that will attack people who have less opportunity, people who have less money, people who have less social position, naturally, people of color are going to take it in the neck. And we see this, of course, all the time. So.
Well, we're running out of time, but before we close, I would be interested in hearing how you see the current environment of repression of reproductive rights as compared to what you were living through during your time as a Jane, which would have been in the 60s, right?
Late 60s, well, the Janes existed, late 60s, early 70s. But of course, you're right, it was being, the buildup to such action was mid to late 60s.
And that was during the time of one of the most severe crackdowns on abortion. So how do you see today in comparison to what was going on back then?
Well, interestingly enough, I think things are worse now. I think that even though, as we like to say, or many people say, Roe is on the books, however tentatively or teeteringly in the moment, the situation, the feelings, the emotions, the political mechanisms that are affected by and are affecting abortion access are far uglier, far more difficult to deal with than they were in our time. For instance, the police, as always, know what's going on in their precincts. They know what's going on in their neighborhoods. And they sure as hell knew about us. And they sent people to us because they knew that we were not, as the old saying went, butchers. They knew that we were well-trained and that we were doing good work. They brought their wives and mistresses and daughters to us. And these days, you're not going to find that so often when inevitably, as things close down in such ugly ways as they are in many Texas and et cetera, as the obvious examples, that's not going to happen. So it's going to be even worse than the worse I am beginning with this statement with.
No, that's interesting because there was a lot of that looking the other way during World War II. And you're saying that there was a fair amount, maybe more than we appreciate, of looking the other way at women like yourself who were providing abortions, underground abortions during the 60s, and that you don't see that that's necessarily going to happen right now?
Well, I think that people are going to take those actions. Yes, I think many good women and maybe some men are going to provide underground service. But right. What I'm saying is that it's far more dangerous now, and they're going to have a much uglier time of it. And the people who are screaming at them in the streets, or screaming at all of us in the streets, are going to be very, very dangerous, a la Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yeah. And like always through history, when abortion becomes illegal, it's usually women who end up providing those underground services.
Mostly so, although yeah. There have been, as the Marines like to say, a few good men.
Well, that's a great place to close our conversation then, I think. Lots more to talk about, but thank you very much, Judith, for coming on to the Old Mole and talking about some of these issues. And we'll have you on again, I'm sure, sometime.
It's a pleasure, as always. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Patricia Kohlberg and Judith Arcana.
For our final episode on today's Old Mole Variety Hour, I talk with Michael Brown, president of the St. John's Heritage Association. Michael's also a longtime friend as a labor activist and brings a multi-generational awareness of the importance of labor and community history from his grandparents to his granddaughter. Michael, I was hoping that was going to be your granddaughter nearby as we spoke. Apparently not. We're talking today because Portland city leadership has just shown its disdain for community history by evicting the St. John's History Museum and its wonderful collection into the street. Michael Brown, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Norman.
Glad to have you here. Many of our listeners tend to think in citywide terms, maybe not realizing that communities within Portland, from St. John's to Cully to Selwood, have their own rich histories that continue to influence their inhabitants today. Tell us a bit about St. John's and kind of the broader area that you're in and that you represent.
Sure. So St. John's was named after James John, Jimmy John. He came to the area in the 1860s. He first settled on the Linton side of the Willamette River. And shortly after that, he came over to the St. John's side. He ran a ferry boat service, and he was one of the original pioneers in the area. Of course, it's only appropriate to show respect to the Native Americans that once inhabited the area as well. Going back a little bit further, Lewis and Clark Exposition, William Clark encountered the Native Americans who were near where Cathedral Park is today. So begin moving forward, James John establishes the community of St. John's. It was known for a long time and still is to some degree as the hardworking blue-collar community. The Terminal 4 was placed there in 1919. You also had the timber industry. Portland Woolen Mills was established in St. John's in 1904 and employed between 500 and 600 workers. And so it was a strong, prospering community, mostly union represented. During that time and forward. And so it's the peninsula. And there's a sense of it's strong, hardworking, blue collar union people. That's what I grew up with in the 1960s.
Why is that history important to the community?
Why is that important?
Yeah, and why is community history important also?
It's preserving the history of the area, but also the people of the area, and how they struggled over the years in different ways. You've got the longshore strike, ILWU or ILA back then in 1934 in the back of Pier Park. But if you don't understand the history and then appreciation, it doesn't go well. You're also showing respect to the community when you do that as well. The war years were very, St. John's very much impacted. You had the Oregon shipyards adjacent to Terminal 4 during that time period. The housing community, you had Parkside homes, and on the backside, there's also wartime housing there. And of course, we extend out beyond St. John's as well, of course, Vanport and so forth. But so it's at one point that was going to be the hub of Portland. It's a sense of a small town, Mayberry kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a rich history. In fact, I enjoy taking young people to Pier Park and actually positioning them and facing them with the kind of dilemma. What if the police were trying to bring scabs through on the train? How would you respond? That's into Terminal 4 and referring, of course, to the 1934 Longshore strike. All that history is important to how we think of ourselves even now. And so bring us up to date. You've had a museum. The museum is full of artifacts that enrich that history. And now what's happened?
Yes. So we're trying to preserve the proud, rich history of St. John's and the people of St. John's. It's a diverse community. We're trying to preserve the labor history. There's the history of women in the area as well. There's a Dr. Graves, a female doctor that practiced for years in St. John's. You also have to only appropriately so, you've got to preserve the Native American history. We have our artifacts. You also have the Japanese American influence there, the Anchi family, the Chinese Americans, the Jower family that was there from 1904, the Winters brothers. Jackson Winters was the first class of 1947 at Roosevelt, the first Black student University of Portland. His brother Jim Winters, class of 49 at Roosevelt, was the first Black basketball coach in the state of Oregon. And so it's a diverse community. The St. John's Heritage Association was formed in 75. We moved into the St. John's City Hall, or the Old North Precinct, in 77. And we've been there during all that time. At one point, the building was remodeled, and there was a grant. And part of the agreement between the city of Portland and the federal government was that when that building was remodeled, that there would be access for the community. And so us being present, the St. John's Heritage Association there with our artifacts in a display case built for us, that helped abide by that agreement between the federal government and the city. So again, we're trying to preserve that proud, rich history. And we would have, we had public events there where we invite the public in to show them the history of St. John's and the people. And the police bureau was there then as well, and they put on a program with us. And so we've had a good relationship. It wasn't only with the police bureau, but it was the city of Portland. The original president was Howard Galbraith. Howard was class of 1930 at Roosevelt. He was the first president of St. John's Heritage Association, and he advocated for years for the funding for what is today Cathedral Park. And he's also helped establish the jazz festival in St. John's. And so then it went to Helen Miles and Norma Reagan. I'm the fourth president. And so I take the stewardship very seriously. You have several buildings within St. John's as well that are important to maintain. They've already torn down two. One of them was the old Central Hotel. It was built in 1902, later became Dad's, the H.F. Clark building. But this is the iconic, this helps represent St. John's. As you come down the St. John's Bridge toward into St. John's, you'll see the old St. John's City Hall on the right there. It has the bell on top of the building, which represented the, originally it was the St. John's Volunteer Fire Department. And the St. John's Police Department was in there as well. And it was also City Hall. So St. John's was a city of its own from 1902 to 1915, when the voters decided to become part of the city of Portland. And part of the agreement was the police presence would be maintained there, but that didn't take place.
What has happened now to that collection?
So the police were there from 1907 to this last August of 2021. Simultaneously, as the police were exiting, the city of Portland advised us that we needed to move all of our artifacts out of the building. I was attempting to negotiate, and not just me, but other historical entities as well, to stay there. And they wouldn't listen. They didn't want to meet with us at the St. John City Hall. They didn't want to see any of our artifacts. And so we had a meeting set up with the city council for November 10th. I asked for an extension to that date, and that was denied. What they told us was, and I can back this up with email, was you need to remove all your items, all your artifacts out of the St. John City Hall, the Old North Precinct, by the end of October, or they were going to move them and store them, and we would be charged. There was a lot of disrespect, definitely, toward the St. John's Heritage Association and the people of St. John's when they did this. There was no dialogue in advance. Later to determine, they used the word that that building is disposable, and also the intention to sell the St. John's City Hall in 3 to 5 years.
Now, you got to address the city council last week, is what I remember. Has that had any consequence? Have they backed off at all?
So that was on November 10th, and they agreed to have follow-up. The mayor apologized for the way that we were treated, the disrespect by the mayor's office. And gentlemen, we had a meeting recently with a representative of the mayor's office. And again, it was kind of like, well, you need to find another location, but at least he did listen to us. And so our goal is to, if we can't have the police there, let's turn that in. There's no more appropriate location to have a St. John's museum than in that old St. John's City Hall building. You've got my group, the St. John's Heritage Association. There's also a museum group. Michael Verbout represents the Roseville Alumni Association. We're affiliated with the Oregon Historical Society. And so there's a whole lot of support and allies working with us. Veteran Foreign Wars as well. We've done some memorial projects, including a video memorial project. So it would be appropriate to turn that into a museum, as other entities have done, rather than what my concern is too, is if it goes into private hands, that it's going to be demolished, just like some of the other historic buildings that have in St. John's.
So there are a couple of things up in the air right now. One is just where the museum artifacts are. They're in storage. They're not so much available to the public at this point as they should be. And the second is the disposition of this classic building, of course. Where do we go from here, Michael? You've given us a little bit of encouraging news that the city is maybe starting to listen. That's news to me. I came prepared this interview to rouse the fighting spirit of our listeners. What would you like from us?
What I would like is support from the community to encourage the city council and the mayor to turn this into a museum for St. John's. Currently, the park rangers are in there. They could be anywhere, no offense to those folks. Right now, our artifacts are at the Oddfellows Museum on North Lombard. David Shearer has allowed us to store them there free of charge in the Oddfellows Museum. The St. John City Hall is a city historical landmark. And I'm told it's also a national historic, federal historic landmark. It is very important, similar to the designation with the bridge. And so that's our goal, is to get the support and turn that into a city or museum for future generations to understand the proud, rich history that we have in St. John's and the people of St. John's.
Okay, as we go out, Michael, you were telling me beforehand the kind of song that came to mind as you went into labor negotiations. So leave us with that. You don't have to sing it, but what are the important lyrics for us to remember? The Johnny Cash lyrics.
Oh, yes, yes. And that is, I won't back down, and we will not back down. This belongs to the people of St. John's, and we're not going to back down. We're going to continue move forward on this. It's a continuation of the persecution and discrimination against the people of North Portland. They're also attempting to close down the historic Columbia Pool permanently, and that's another fight. But this is just one more indication of the disrespect towards the people of St. John's. There was no discussion about removing the police from St. John's. And this is just a continuation in the pool and removing us from the St. John's City Hall. It's a very important role that we play. We take that stewardship very seriously.
Michael Brown, you've got our support. Thanks for talking with us this morning. This has been Norm Diamond with Michael Brown for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Norman.
And that's our program for today. Thanks to Old Mole's Bill Resnick and Patricia Kohlberg for their contributions. To our guests, Tina Gerhardt, Judith Arcana, and Michael Brown. And to Old Mole's Denise Morris and John Nelson for their editing help. Thanks, too, to the staff at KABU for their guidance and responsiveness in difficult circumstances. Remember that tomorrow begins KABU's end-of-the-year drive. KABU is on the air because of its listeners' support. As I said earlier, if you're able, please stay alert to the station's needs and contribute. We'll go out with a bit of the music Michael Brown mentioned. It's Johnny Cash singing, "I Won't Back Down." Catch you next Monday morning. Stay safe and stay active.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down.